This is Stan, and this is Civil Banter. We're two civil litigators at Nelligan Law, helping people through injuries, insurance fights, and life's legal curveballs. You're joining us on episode number 10.
Paparazzi, surveillance, and personal injury claims. We're going to have fun with this one.
Yeah. This is a topic that we get asked about all the time. It comes up constantly. It's always something that I think lawyers get really obsessive over it.
Clients get really obsessive over it, and not unjustifiably.
Yeah, so we're going to get into it. We're going to chop it up. But before we do that, we're going into arguably my favorite segment, frequently asked and answered questions. This is the FAAQs. And in this segment, we'll be answering all the questions that you've been too afraid to ask your lawyer.
Yeah, I like it.
Okay, so Stan, two questions off the top. So the first question is, can the other lawyer use what I say in my lawsuit in another lawsuit?
No. Okay. No. Unless there's a court order. There's a few exceptions. We'll get to it. But like the general rule is no. What you learn of in a lawsuit stays in the lawsuit. It's called the deemed undertaking rule, and that's because it applies automatically. It is deemed to apply the minute that you're into the lawsuit and you're going through the discovery process. And basically what it means is that you undertake as a party to a lawsuit not to share the information you've learned of in your lawsuit outside of that lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And it's a way of ensuring that privacy is maintained, that there's truthfulness and frank answers to questions, and just keeping a lid on things, right? Like it doesn't need to be sprayed all over the place. It should not be publicly disclosed. And it's actually codified in law. So it is the law that you cannot talk about things you learn in a lawsuit outside of the lawsuit. This covers documents. It covers transcripts from cross-examinations. Mm-hmm. Answers to undertakings, which are really just viewed as a continuation of documents, but any other information obtained through the discovery process. And there are four exceptions. Do you want to run through those?
Yeah, we'll run through those. So consent, pretty obvious.
Yeah.
If everyone agrees that there's no issue with this being shared, it can be shared.
I could see why somebody who learned something very good about somebody would consent to that nice thing being released into the world.
Maybe right.
They, you know, donated a large sum of money anonymously, but it comes out in the lawsuit and they say, hey, can I share this? Yes. Have my consent to do so.
And then with leave, which is permission of the court. So that's if you had to bring a motion. I can't say off the top of my head how or why this would come up, but I'm sure there's case law out there where there has been leave to breach the deemed undertaking rule on the right facts.
There must be. I don't want to wade into it because it sounds fraught with landmines.
And it sounds like another episode too.
It does sound like that. Yeah, that sounds like a great episode.
If the information is otherwise publicly available, so this is a way to basically, you don't want someone just trying to shield information that is in the public domain by being like, hey, I produced that to you.
Right. And I guess that could be maybe a property information that mm-hmm. is at the land registry office, or it's publicly available in that manner. Then, you know, you can't claim privilege over that.
Mm-hmm. And same with, an obvious use is impeaching someone's credibility in the same proceeding. And impeaching, I don't know. I love that word, but
I love it too. And I love doing it. If you can actually pull it off in court, it is awesome.
But it basically means to attack someone's credibility by showing a contradiction between what they're saying. So if it's a document where you're going to use it in that proceeding to say, well, no, this contradicts what you're saying, you can do it in court, you're impeaching their credibility.
That's another episode. I think that's another fun episode. We'll come back to impeachment and the whole process. It's a little maybe technical, but I love it and we'll have to do it.
Yeah. And I'd also, you know, just thinking out loud, when we're looking at the deemed undertaking rule, I'd really like to pick a commercial litigator's brain about this in terms of how successful it is and whether that is. My assumption is that it's trying to also prevent, you know, basically a collateral attack where you start a lawsuit to get production of documents that could have, you know, I don't know, trade secrets or business processes or damning information that you really, you don't care about the underlying lawsuit. You just want to use it for something else entirely, whether it's developing a product or competing with someone, or I bet it gets very spicy in the commercial setting.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's a great, another future topic.
And when it comes up, the deemed undertaking rule and questions about it come up in my practice, it's often in the context of, you know, income tax filings. When something's not been reported or there's an issue with an income tax filing, which happens all the time in a variety.
Wait, hold on. You've had clients who've earned money and haven't reported it to the Canada Revenue Agency? You're not prepared to answer that.
Yeah, neither confirm nor deny. But, you know, the clients want to know that by accurately and honestly testifying about what happened and why, they're not going to just be immediately, you know, the defense lawyer is not going to be, well, after the CRA I go, like, yeah, I'm taking this.
Crush you in this other proceeding with this. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not going to happen. And that's one of the things that frequently comes up when we say, don't worry, deemed undertaking rule. It would be deeply unethical and problematic for someone to try and breach that in that manner.
For sure.
Okay.
Got another one for me?
Another one. So, is what I tell my doctor confidential?
Yes and no. Basically, yes. Almost always, yes. You know, what you tell your doctor, they're bound not to share without your permission, essentially. And you should be happy to share your information with your doctor. It can become relevant in personal injury litigation, because that's really what it's all about, is mm-hmm. how hurt are you? What are the extent of your injuries? What are the extent of the impairments that you're suffering from? And in this case, you will almost certainly always authorize your doctor to release that information. Mm-hmm. So you'll give them permission, basically, is how that works. And, you know, sometimes you'll be very reluctant to do that. It will have to happen almost every time, because it's squarely relevant, and it would fall under this deemed undertaking. So it's not going to be spread around the lawsuit. I can tell you, we do defense work, we do plaintiff work, we're on both sides of this coin. We don't really, honestly, I mean, care is the wrong word. We care about your lawsuit, we care about what's in there, but we don't take it home and we don't talk about it mm-hmm. with anybody. We've seen almost everything there is to see in medical records, and it stays within your lawsuit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, unfortunately, if you're going to be involved in personal injury litigation, your medical records could become producible. I wouldn't say they're public, mm-hmm. but they will be producible.
Right. And, you know, as you said, even in situations, and I think clients sometimes have a hard time with this, even in situations where a defense lawyer is being very assertive and aggressive on discovery, and comes across, you know, in a very particular way, that really does say nothing at all about that lawyer and how they treat their ethical obligations at all. We all take it very seriously. And just because on discovery as part of being an advocate, that drilling down about medical records, that doesn't mean that they're going to breach a serious rule or anything like that. And anything
almost certainly the opposite.
Yeah. And they, and it's also, it's never going to be new to them. It's part of the job. We see this stuff all the time. So yeah, you're right. In a sense, a defense lawyer isn't going to, you know, in the abstract, care about someone's medical records. It's just a means to an end of defending their client.
That's right. All right. Time for me to ask a question of you. So one thing that we always hear from clients, right? How am I going to pay for this? And if I win at my lawsuit, is the defendant going to pay me some money?
Right. So the general principle is, at a top level, is the loser pays the winner's costs.
All of them?
Not all of them. Almost always not all of them.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to get all of them.
Yeah. So and to be clear, this only kicks in after a trial. So you get all the way through a trial, and then you are now the winner. and the loser has to pay a portion of your legal costs.
Right. Yeah, you don't win until it's over.
Right. And so the portion they will pay is what we call partial indemnity or substantial indemnity. And that's just a highfalutin way of saying generally 60% or 80, 90%.
Some or most.
Yeah, some or most.
Yeah.
That's what would be awarded in addition to whatever damage award. It's in very minute number of situations where you would have all of your legal fees paid, and the default would be partial. So it would be, 60% of your legal fees would be covered.
And that concept of not getting all of your legal fees back, I've always understood it as, well, there has to be an incentive to settle. Mm-hmm. And if you know that you're going to get 100% of your legal fees back, there's zero incentive for you to settle your lawsuit other than not having the money in the interim to fund it. Mm-hmm. But if you're well-heeled enough, well-pocketed enough, and you were to know that you're going to get 100% of your legal fees back, then it will become a tactic to outspend the other party.
Right.
And so the courts want to disincentivize that kind of, obviously financial bullying type of behavior. And so there's an incentive to resolve, and there's an incentive to play nice by saying you're not going to get 100% of your legal fees, and that this is, an inherently risky thing, and you don't want to waste the court's time. You don't want to be bullying other sides with legal fees. So you should expect 60, and in the event that you've, served an offer to settle and beaten that offer, maybe you get up to 80 or 90.
Right. And then, a lot of claims resolved by settlement. If you're settling, then again, it's an open question. It's like, are you entitled to costs? I'd say by convention, you're entitled to having some reasonable portion of your legal fees covered as agreed, basically. So it really is a negotiated figure.
Yeah, like any settlement, there's it's a negotiation, exactly as you said. So it's going to be harder to say for sure what's going to happen.
Yeah, and the kind of convention, at least, I don't know if it's Eastern Ontario only. I'm ignorant about the source of this convention, but the entire time I've been practicing, the convention in terms of, at least in personal injury litigation, when you're making a claim for legal costs in a negotiated settlement, not after a hearing or a trial, the convention is of the first $100,000 of a damage award, you can expect by convention to ask for 15% of that in legal costs. And of the every $100,000 in amounts thereafter, you can expect to receive 10%.
Yeah, the old 15 and 10 rule we hear about. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's just that's because of contingency fees. So instead of actually calculating what your contingency fee is, we do this 15 and 10 thing. It's a little, into the weeds. But mm-hmm. I have another question. This is one that maybe it doesn't come up at the beginning of a file, mm-hmm. but towards the end, especially those who know they've got a winner, they start to wonder about how am I going to get this money if I win my lawsuit, right? It's kind of easy if you're up against a municipality or, mm-hmm. The government, because they are well pocketed and obviously will pay you. But if you're up against, a private citizen, how do you get paid?
Right. So it's a separate enforcement proceeding. So at the end of your trial, you get a judgment. And that judgment orders the payment of money. But to actually get the money, the court, the judge, the court staff don't proactively go and get that money or seize those assets. They only do it in accordance with the enforcement processes, which can involve using a sheriff.
I love that term. And, a lot of people here don't realize that Canada's chock full of sheriffs.
Yeah.
It's not the Wild West, but their job title is sheriff.
Right. So it's not automatic and it can be slow and cumbersome. Obviously, there are some people who are, they have a niche in terms of enforcement processes, and there are many different ways to do it. You can You can get, if you know someone's employed, you can garnish a portion of their wages.
Yeah, you can't take it all. They still need to live.
If you can, through investigative efforts, track down a bank account, you can enforce against a bank account. You can register documents on title to real property, like houses, and enforce through power of sale proceedings against real property, which may or may not make sense depending on the amount of money owed. And you can pull people into examinations where you get to question them on their assets and their location, so you can then target them. But it's a self-directed process to turn that paper judgment into actual dollars and cents recovery.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate because a lot of the time, you know, clients will go to the great expense of winning their lawsuit, which is not cheap. And then they will have to go to further expense of enforcing the lawsuit, mm-hmm. which is, again, not cheap. And sometimes you're trying to get blood from a stone. I can say, having done a couple of judgment debtor exams, they're mm-hmm. very invasive. So if you are a defendant who's got a judgment against them, you should probably pay that, because otherwise you'll get hauled into an examination where you'll have to testify under oath about every single thing you own, down to how much money's in your wallet at the time.
Yeah. And all these things are, you know, they're difficult and they're cumbersome and they're time consuming, but the while it's a process that the plaintiff or the creditor, the person who's owed the money, has to go through, there really is teeth to it. And ultimately, it's not a problem that if you ignore it will go away. You can be jailed.
Totally. Yeah. If you don't want to participate in the enforcement process, it will be enforced upon you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not automatic, but there is a process, and it can result in someone getting jailed if they're constantly delinquent, not and just assuming it will go away.
And that's contempt of court.
Contempt of court. That would be and if that someone repeatedly fails to go to a debtor exam is where I've seen it deployed. And personally, when I have enforcement questions and things get tricky, which fortunately, like, you know, when we're dealing with insurance companies and larger institutions, they're more likely to just pay the judgment. But when we're dealing with individuals, I knock on Caitlin Cardill's door at our office. She knows, she has a wealth of information about enforcement.
What a problem solver.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's who I go to.
Awesome.
Okay. Moving on to the topic of the episode. So we're talking surveillance, as we alluded to at the top. So
what is it?
What is surveillance? In a personal injury action, the defendant's insurance company often, frequently hires a private investigator to physically and manually surveil, like James Bond-ish, CIA-ish style, in a white van
yeah,
with a telephoto lens, will go and literally record and photograph an injured plaintiff.
Yeah, they'll park in front of your house and slap a video camera up and wait until you leave. Then they'll follow you wherever you go. You go to the grocery store, they're going to follow you through the grocery store and watch you pick up the case of Coke and put it on your cart and wheel it out and put it in your car.
And to be clear, this is not for the duration of the lawsuit. And
no, it's not for like a week.
Yeah, and it's not in every lawsuit.
So I'd say it's less than half of them.
Yeah, but there's some where what the defendant wants, and it probably, you know, the defendant's dream, the private investigator's dream, is to be sued by someone who's complaining of a fractured ankle, and they can't walk, they walk with a limp, and then they get the surveillance showing them, you know, in the Bywood Market, dancing on a bar.
Yeah,
yeah.
Playing elite level soccer.
Yeah. So that's what they're looking for. It's often way less interesting and way less dramatic than that.
Yeah, we hyped it up a lot. Most of the surveillance is pretty dull. You know, it's usually because the people are legitimately injured, they don't leave the house.
Right.
So they'll do a surveillance for a couple of days, and they'll maybe catch them walk out to the car and maybe go through the drive-through at Tim Hortons and then go back home. Really nothing to that. So I'd say in the vast majority of circumstances, the surveillance really isn't that damaging to somebody's case. And, you know, it's an interesting topic, but a lot of the time in practice, it's not.
Yeah. And, you know, the I don't know enough about the technical side of it. And I'd really be interested in, you know, speaking with a private investigator or having one on or getting some details about the mechanics. But what I see is often the end result. And I've never been on a defense file where I've been the person instructing.
I've done that a lot.
Yeah, I haven't done that. So on plaintiff's files, you know, we use private investigators from time to time, but in different capacities, usually regarding finding someone, locating someone, sometimes on liability related things, going places, taking photographs, but it's rarely just generally kind of, you know, tracking and observing someone and photographing it. But, you know, a lot of the surveillance I've seen, at least in my own practice, is often, and I think for good practical reasons, it's blurry. The camera shakes a lot. It's from a very far distance. It's hard to see what's going on. So, and there's frequent cuts because, you know, you can imagine how expensive it gets to hire someone to go follow this individual around all day for multiple days.
Yeah. And, you know, it actually gets expensive for the lawyers as well, because when it does get close to a trial, or maybe even a discovery, you're going to ask for the entirety of the surveillance file, not just the cuts in the surveillance that show the bad parts. Mm-hmm. You'll ask for all of it, and you'll have to watch all of it. And mm-hmm. you can be sitting there for hours watching surveillance, you know, and maybe if you're on for the plaintiff, you know, they've shown your client doing a little dance. Well, what they might not have shown you is the next day they're limping around because their injury is actually significant and they just mm-hmm. gritted their way through a wedding for a family member, but they're paying for it the next day. So you have to look at it in the big context of that.
Right. And, you know, surveillance is something where there's rules around its disclosure. And the general principle is, you know, no trial by ambush.
That's right. Be upfront about it.
Yeah.
Which also helps settle the file, honestly.
Yeah. If you have killer surveillance and you're on discovery and you're asked about it, you have to disclose its existence, provide particulars. And if you're going to be using it at trial, you don't just get to, on day one of trial, be like, by the way, I have all the surveillance, which completely wins my case.
Yeah. I think the judge would be very upset with that defense lawyer and would wield the cost consequences appropriately.
Right. And, you know, as you said, what often gets some of the disputes around the production of it, I think it's more clear cut now, but clear cut to pardon pun. But you know, what's often produced is the product the private investigator first gives to the defense lawyer who's instructing them is an edited, trimmed down version, like the greatest hits of the surveillance I just took.
Yeah, sometimes it'll be just a paper report with some screenshots right. of the video. Sometimes it will be just the clips, the shorts. Of the video, and usually the defense lawyer like won't have the full video unless they specifically request mm-hmm. it.
And then you know, as things get more serious and people are getting closer to trial, that's when you know, good plaintiff's counsel will be demanding the full unedited surveillance so that they can go through the time-consuming process of reviewing it all, so that when they're confronted with this, or if they want to bring a trial motion about it, which trial motions about surveillance seem like they happen constantly.
Yeah, they do, about, you know, the extent that it can be used, how much we're going to see, you know, also getting it in, mm-hmm. right? So you have to show the chain of ownership over the video, and the person who performed the surveillance has to come, and they're typically voir dired on it and explain what their process was, the equipment they were used, where did they store it, has it been edited, what was done to edit mm-hmm. it, those kinds of things. It's honestly, it's more bother than it's worth yeah. unless it's really good video.
And there's often that thing where it's strengths and weaknesses. Often the surveillance I've seen is like, well, I saw that and that's bad for the plaintiff's case, but then I saw this other thing and I think that's actually good for the plaintiff's case. Like, yes, the plaintiff was doing something that seems like it, or it could be argued, contradicts what they're saying, but this other place that was only in the unedited footage, here's my plaintiff walking around with a limp or exhibiting grimaces or that type of thing. So
yeah, I find it most powerful when it's used to impeach. And so we've talked about impeachment a little bit before. it's most powerful to demonstrate that the person is lying. Mm-hmm. So if they use absolute terms like, oh, I never go for a run, I never sweep the floor, and you've got video of them going for a run, well, it's not so much for the fact that they can go for a run once a month or once a week. It's for the fact that they've lied or misstated, to be generous about it, their capabilities. And then if they're not being truthful or honest about that, how far does that go? So that's really, I think, where it's most compelling, mm-hmm. as opposed to like, oh, we got you walking briskly.
Right.
So what?
Right. And, you know, how does, we discuss how there's often motions about surveillance. The process of how the evidence actually gets in at trial is a general evidence question, which is how does any evidence get in right. a trial in terms yeah. of what's allowed to form part of the record. It's not anything goes. It's a bit technical, but it's basically the test is probative value versus prejudicial effect, which means how much does this really tell us, and is it useful that mm-hmm. it tells us this
right
versus are there any negative consequences, you know, big unfairness issues where it could overwhelm the jury's decision making, that type of thing. And then one of the questions that, you know, or some of the relevant questions are, well, is this video footage a true and accurate depiction of what actually happened? Or are there issues with it in terms of, is it just hard to make out what's going on? Is it too low resolution?
Right.
Is
yeah.
it blurry? If there are timestamps, are the timestamps accurate? Why are there cuts or gaps? Is there an explanation to why there are cuts, when and where there are cuts? Is this things obscuring it? Is there there's any number of different things. And I think someone who had know-how about how these camera systems actually work and depth of field and focus distances and all that stuff could all be relevant in determining, you know, should this get in, or is there a risk that it doesn't really assist anyone? It doesn't really get to the question being asked, and it has this risk that in when a jury sees it, it might color their opinion.
Well, I think, and I was always, and I still do advise the defense clients this way, if your surveillance isn't amazing, do you really want to roll it? For a few reasons. Number one, if it doesn't show anything bad, what are you doing? You're mm-hmm. you're just wasting time, and maybe you're even demonstrating that this person's complaints are all legitimate. But I think most importantly, surveillance kind of got like an ick factor about it, I think, that it's sort of like the idea that somebody is surreptitiously observing you for large periods of time, it doesn't sit well with people. Mm-hmm. And so if you're on a jury and the defendant rolls out a week's worth of surveillance, they're going to think like, they've like followed this poor plaintiff around mm-hmm. and like nothing's really that damaging. I don't like that they've done this. I would not want this done to me. And I don't know. I'd be quite hesitant about just going out crazy with the surveillance because I really, again, we're not allowed to speak to jurors, but I wouldn't want that done to me. And so I think jurors very much think the same way.
True. I do think, though, there is an element of, I think a picture is worth a thousand words, and we are in such a document-based practice most of the time that when you see the video footage, which is that there's no, everything else is expert reports, medical reports, it's all just document-based, you see what's happening, it can be so powerful. And I know that, you know, you get surveillance as a plaintiff's lawyer, you it's been produced, and before you know, your heart skips a beat before yeah. you open it, you're like,
oh boy,
yeah, yeah. What am I about to get into?
Well, I think this is a good segue to surveillance versus social media evidence,
right?
And I think there's an important distinction there in that social media is being put out by the plaintiff, mm-hmm. right? They are the authors of this product and they are sending it to the public as mm-hmm. opposed to being surveilled.
Mm-hmm. And I think this, you know, I haven't checked in on recent cases about how it's been used. I've read some from time to time. I don't think there's been sort of a foundational decision on its limits or what it really tells us, because it's, I think, generally speaking, we're all aware that, you know, social media on the one hand, you know, it's very, it can be potentially very curated, and there's a whole social system in place of what type of stuff you want to put out there and what slice of someone's life that shows.
So, true. They are picking the highlights.
Right.
For
so,
sure.
So a lot of the time, I think it lacks so much context that it's not useful. However, just the lawyer in me is like, please don't risk disclosing more than you need to for free in an open format if you're involved in litigation. Because while it might take hours and hours for someone to follow a plaintiff around in a van with a telephoto lens, it's significantly easier and cheaper to just have a private investigator who knows what they're doing do what's called open source intelligence research. So that's going on
Instagram, Facebook,
LinkedIn, Snapchat, deep web. I've seen referenced a lot. I've never really followed, and I think that's just something I don't know. I've seen references to deep web in surveillance reports, but basically, if it's been put out there voluntarily, openly, then there's ways it can be easily got, recorded, captured, and then a narrative can be built around that.
Yeah, and for me, it lacks the ick factor as well. It's like, mm-hmm. you've done this to yourself. You put this out there, right?
True.
Like, you know, so I find the social media a little bit more damaging than surveillance, obviously, unless the surveillance is incredible and, mm-hmm. you know, the person is doing exactly what they said they couldn't do, in which case it's extremely valuable.
Which is interesting, though, because, again, we've just said that, you know, assuming surveillance is done properly, like real physical surveillance, because I have any number of clients who are just like, yeah, there's someone surveilling me and they just know it's happening. And then if they know it's happening, then its utility is essentially zero.
But right.
Assuming it's done properly and the plaintiff does not know they're being surveilled, then it's at least in to an extent, like they don't know they're being recorded. So whatever they're doing isn't colored by that. Whereas social media posts, I think, are manipulated in a sense. They might literally be manipulated in terms of like filters
editing, to look cropping. Good. Yeah.
But then also if you take, you know, how many people take 25 pictures and they select the best one.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's just such a narrow slice. And I think it's going to continue to pose both lawyers and decision makers problems in terms of what weight do we or do we not give this? And is there an explanation? Is there not an explanation? It's definitely a very 2025 problem to be dealing with.
Absolutely it is.
Okay. And then just briefly, we'll tap into just a couple of war stories. And one is, it's happened a number of times actually, but when you get the surveillance and you see it and you say, there's a problem with the surveillance. It seems to be video footage of someone who vaguely fits my client's description, but is definitely not my client.
That's awesome.
And then perhaps addressing that at mediation, perhaps in a without prejudice format when you say, by the way,
yeah, guess what?
This is not my client.
Yeah, great video, really capable person. Not actually my client, so.
And then the other one has to be just the surveillance where is the opposite of what you said about not contradicting. When I have been on a file and I saw surveillance footage once, and it was someone who complained of a shoulder injury, and they were just doing essentially like heavy manual labor for like hours, like multiple hours in serious heat.
Yeah.
It was just an athletic showcase.
I had one of those too.
And it was just impossible to reconcile.
Yeah. I had shoulder complaints, and then the individual who was making those complaints was filmed at the gym shoulder pressing 60-pound dumbbells. And you're just like,
you know, that's but impressive. I would also just say, you know, as we always like to say, it depends.
True. Yeah. Maybe you've got like really great directional up, but it's across causing you problems.
What if you used to be able to shoulder press 140 pounds and now you're at 60?
Right. Yeah. That's
could be compatible. Who knows?
Yeah. That's true.
Okay. Well, I think with that, we'll wrap up our paparazzi episode and we'll say our goodbyes. So you can find our team at nelliganlaw.ca. You can find me on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/in/HMillsMcEwen.
Same for me, linkedin.com/in/StanfordCummings.
Comments, questions, topic suggestions, thoughts on surveillance. Is this shocking for you to find out? Did you always assume it was a thing? Are you a lawyer that has your own surveillance war stories that you'd like to share with us? You can reach us at civilbanter@nelliganlaw.ca.
Yeah. And, we look forward to any, likes that you can put on this. It goes a long way for us, and sharing with your friends would be appreciated as well.
Yeah. If you can share this with one or two friends or family members, it goes a long way. Get the word out there. And with that, that is a wrap.
Thanks, everybody.